I think I forgot to introduce myself earlier. So my name's Pete. Together with my wife, Bea, we lead the church. If we've not met you before, massive, massive welcome to KXC. Okay, if you've got a Bible, for all two of you that brought your own Bible, you might want to get your Bible out. Otherwise, turn your smartphones on and get the Bible Gateway out. Otherwise, grab one of the Pew Bibles. If you don't own a Bible, take the Pew Bible, put your name in it. It's our gift to you. We encourage you to read it, perhaps starting in the Gospels, which is about halfway through. Start reading it. We genuinely believe it will transform your life. And once you've got the Bible open, turn to Ephesians chapter 3, which I'm not actually going to teach on, but Johnny read it earlier. So I just want to start at this point because Paul's prayer for the church in Ephesus is essentially my prayer for tonight. So let's just read it again. And the heartbeat of this prayer is that we would know the love of God. And not just intellectually, we would experientially know, grab hold of, be shaped by, be compelled by, be sent out by the love of God. Like, this is critical. And Paul's writing to the church in Ephesus saying, if you want to make your lives count for the kingdom of God, there's a Roman Empire that's wanting to crush out Christianity, rip apart your faith. If you want to not just survive, but if you want to thrive under that kind of oppression, you need to grab hold of the love of God. So this is what he says. He says, I pray that out of his glorious riches, he may strengthen you with power through his spirit in your inner being, so that Christ may dwell in your hearts through faith. And I pray that you, being rooted and established in love, like deep roots, it goes deep. That's the point. That you may have power together with all the Lord's holy people to grasp how wide and long and high and deep is the love of Christ. And here's the key verse then. And to know this love that surpasses knowledge, that you may be filled to the measure of all the fullness of God. To know this love that surpasses knowledge. Now, let's just focus on this one word, to know. We've been shaped, at least in part, by an Enlightenment worldview. And when we talk about knowledge, we talk about a rational understanding of something. But pre the Enlightenment, go back to the ancient world, go back to the first century, they had a different understanding of knowledge. Let me give you a little insight into this word, to know. In the gospel narratives, when it says that Mary, the mother of Jesus, was a virgin, the way it actually says it is that Mary had not known a man. Mary had not known a man. In other words, she hadn't experienced a man in that way. You know what I'm talking about, right? Yeah, you're just looking blank. You get what I'm saying. She hadn't experienced that level of intimacy with a man. So this idea of knowledge isn't just mental assent to a set of propositions. It's not just an intellectual thing. It's something deeply experiential. It's like intimate. So Paul says, I pray that you would know this love that surpasses knowledge. I pray that you would know it, not just give your mental assent to it, but it would grab hold of you, that you'd be consumed by it. It would be an unbelievable experience that brings about intimacy, that brings about life. That's what we're going after this evening. Sound good? Tough crowd, tough crowd. It's going to be good. You're going to enjoy it. There we go. So we're going to start with an awkward exercise. And let me explain the exercise before we actually do it. In a minute, I'm going to ask people to pair up, to turn to the person on your left or to your right. We're going to look them in the eye and hold their gaze for 2 full minutes. Yeah, no talking, just pure eye contact. Okay, let's just pause. We're not going to do it. Okay, just to sort of set people at ease, we are not going to do it. We're not going to do it. I just wanted to stir up the emotions that you might experience if you knew you were going to have to eyeball someone for 2 minutes. And we've never had that level of excitement in the room at KXC before. I mean, that was unbelievable. And my hunch is there were 3 groups in the room. Firstly, there were the groups of like, bring it on. I've seen who's on my left. And I want to look them in the eye for the next 2 minutes. And I'm going to bring my A game to this exercise. Like, I'm going to know them, they're going to know me, and they're going to hunt me down in the pub afterwards. Bring on the next 2 minutes. Now, for those people, we respect your confidence. Well done. But the vast majority of us in the room were probably panicking somewhat, right? Thinking, I don't want to do this exercise. Is it awkward if I just leave the room right now? Some of you, your heart is still like racing. You were experiencing sort of mild panic. And you were thinking, I don't want someone to look at me for 2 minutes. I don't want them to sort of study my face because they'll see my complexion and they'll notice that scar and that mole and that they might see my teeth or my nose or some part of my face that I don't like. I don't want someone looking me in the face for 2 minutes. Some of you are experiencing that, right? Others were experiencing something beyond just concern about your aesthetics. You were thinking, I don't want someone looking me in the eyes. Because what if they actually see beyond my eyes and they look into something of who I really am? And maybe they'll see some of my insecurity. Maybe they'll see some of my self-doubt. Maybe they might even see some of my self-hatred. I don't want them looking into my soul. So like, what do I do? Like, feeling anxiety. Like, recent research suggests that most adults spend on average 9 hours looking at a screen every day. Like, if you work at a desk, working at a computer, and then add in Netflix time, add in on your smartphone, add in iPad, add in reading on your Kindle, on average, we spend 9 hours looking into a screen, and yet 2 minutes face-to-face terrifies most of us. Because what we long for, what we crave for, is that kind of connection that you might experience in those 2 minutes, but we're desperately afraid of something else. What we're afraid of is judgment. That if I look at someone and they look at me, what if they judge my aesthetics? What if more than that, they look into something of my essence and they don't like it and I experience judgment? I crave for connection, but what if I experience judgment? That would be too much to bear. So most of us don't really hold eye contact. We walk around the place looking at our screens or looking at the floor, and we don't look each other in the eye. But that's where connection's found, and that's the beginning of intimacy. So I want to show you a video. The video is going to play in the background as I begin to continue the talk. And this is a film made by Amnesty International. And essentially, they got some refugees who just moved to Europe to get in a room together, knowing that there would be a massive language barrier, that they couldn't really communicate through language, but they were asked just to eyeball a strange person sat a few feet away from them for 4 minutes. And all of the fears that maybe we were experiencing were present. Like, I'm new in this place. Like, I'm a refugee. Like, I'm away from home. And I've got some anxieties about, can I belong here? And will I be welcomed here? I'm craving connection, but I'm afraid of judgment. And for 4 minutes, they just look people in the eye and they weren't allowed to say a word. Some of them begin to try and talk and use their hands, but a lot of them, they're just looking at each other. It's the beginning of connection, right? But we fear judgment. We fear judgment. I want to up the ante. I want to ask you this question. If I offered you 4 minutes looking into the face of God, would you take it? If I offered you 4 minutes to look into the face of God, would you take it? And the answer is that most people in this city would say, no way. No way. Because I crave connection, but I really fear judgment. And experiencing judgment from peers and family members and other human beings, that's pretty brutal. But experiencing that kind of judgment from some cosmic divine being, that would tear me apart. So no, I'd rather not look at the face of God. And they miss out on this intimacy that Paul was talking about. Some of you will have friends that are intrigued by the person of Jesus. Some of you in the room, you know Jesus, you love him, you've tasted his love. Some of you have good friends that are atheists, that don't believe in God at all. And if you ask an atheist this question, and I encourage you, give it a try. Ask an atheist this question. Tell me about the God you don't believe in. Describe him to me. Like, what's his nature? What's his essence? What's his character like? If you could look into his face, what would you see? Now, an atheist might respond in a number of different ways. They might say, that makes no sense, the question, because I don't believe God exists. So how can I describe the character of a God that I don't believe exists? It's a solid answer. But a number of atheists would say, well, okay, fine, I'll tell you about the God I don't believe in. He's angry and he's distant. and he creates the world, but then removes himself like a withdrawn, dysfunctional dad. And he sets a moral code so high that it's unachievable. And then when human beings don't reach that bar, he punishes them. And he weighs them down with guilt and with shame. Yeah, this God I don't believe in. He's homophobic and he's a racist and he hates this people group and that people group. And they just begin to wax lyrical, right? You might have friends like that. The point I'm trying to make is a lot of people don't believe in God. And a lot of people don't like the God they actually do believe in. A lot of people don't believe in God, and a lot of people don't like the God they actually do believe in. And the picture of God they have in mind is potentially shaped by their experience of human father figures, authority figures, parental figures, where they longed for connection, but they felt judgment. They longed to see pride in the face of mum and dad, but saw this disapproving face and it killed them. Some of them rocked up at church, hoping that church would be a place of grace where they'd experience a welcome and an embrace, and they experienced judgment and it killed them. And all these experiences knit together and get projected upwards to this point of saying, judgment from a fellow human being is brutal. But experiencing that level of judgment from a cosmic being, I don't think I could cope. So I'd rather not see the face of God. A lot of people dismiss Christianity because they're not interested in seeing the face of Jesus. This is what the Alpha Course is about. It's an opportunity to explore the face of Jesus. Because in the face of Jesus, we see the character and nature of God. And it's unbelievably good news. Like if we really grabbed hold of it, if we took what Paul was saying seriously, like I pray that you would know the height, the width, the depth of this love. You would know this love that surpasses knowledge, that you'd be filled to the measure of the fullness of God. Like if we really grabbed hold of that, we'd be inviting all our friends to Alpha because I want you to see the face of God, because the face of God will change your life. Because we have this panic, right? That if we look upwards, we're going to see judgment. And I want to tell you, if you read the scriptures about God and you read about the person of Jesus who reveals the face of God as you look up, what you're actually going to see isn't judgment. It's something called mercy. It says in the Bible that mercy triumphs over judgment. Mercy is a word we don't really use much in the surrounding culture. There's other forms of love that we talk about, romantic love, brotherly love, parental love, all these different forms of love. But mercy is this kind of beautiful form of love that triumphs over judgment, that washes away mistakes and shame so that we can be reconciled and experience intimacy, connection. So I want to tell you some stories of people that were terrified of judgment and then they saw the face of God and it changed everything. Because what they saw in the face of God was mercy. So two stories. If you've got Bibles, you can follow it. But otherwise, I'm just going to tell you a paraphrased version of the story anyway. So John chapter 8 is the first story. It's the story of a lady caught in the act of adultery. Now, John, the writer of this gospel account, this biography of Jesus, he wants us to know the detail. So he wants us to know that this lady was caught in the act of, not just before, not just after, in the act of adultery. So we have a mental picture. I don't want you to think too much about it. But the point is that she's naked, almost certainly naked, okay? So she's been caught in the act. She's been dragged from this sexual encounter and she's been dragged naked into the temple courts, the gathering point for the Jewish community where they go to worship God and do life and hang out with one another. And then suddenly as they're hanging out, this naked woman is dragged, thrown on the floor. And then these teachers of the law, they come to Jesus because he's this rabbi, this guy who's healing the sick and raising the dead and announcing that the kingdom of God is at hand. And he's beginning to make claims that he is God incarnate, that he's God in human flesh, that as you see him in the face, you're looking God in the face. These are big claims. So they want to sort of test him. So they throw this woman on the ground and the crowd, imagine this, they begin to sort of encircle her like, oh my goodness, what's happening? And the teachers of the law say to Jesus, like, what should we do with her? Now, already, the people in the crowd, they're beginning to lift up rocks from the temple floor. from the temple court's floor. And they're getting ready to hurl these rocks, sizable rocks, at this woman. This isn't because it's like an angry crowd. This isn't just the mob mentality. They're doing that because this is a Jewish crowd. And the Jewish people knew the Torah, the first five books of the Bible that contain the Jewish law, the framework for life. They knew it inside out. And they knew the punishment for a woman caught in the act of adultery was death by stoning. So as she's dragged into the temple courts, thrown on the floor, the crowd, they begin to pick up these rocks and they're getting ready to hurl these rocks at this woman and stone her to death. Now, let's just try and emotionally engage in the story, right? Not detach ourselves. Let's engage in the story. Imagine how terrified this woman would have been. Like, here she is. She's naked, disheveled, like utterly humiliated, drowning in shame, cowering, seeing the crowd emerge, holding rocks, getting ready to throw them at her. She'd have been utterly, utterly traumatized in that moment, right? And the teachers say to Jesus, what do we do with her? And he pauses and he begins to write something on the ground, and none of us know what he actually wrote on the ground. But just imagine the tension in this encounter. Everyone looking at the woman, everyone looking at Jesus. This Jesus, who's a rabbi, who's a teacher of the law, who knows the Torah inside out. He knows that if someone's caught in the act of adultery, they should be stoned to death. What is he going to say? And then Jesus steps into the encounter and he says to the crowd, let him who's without sin, you throw the first stone. And the crowd are like, what? Does that say that in the Torah? I don't think it says that in the Torah, does it? What? And then slowly but surely, you can hear, doof, doof, doof. And that's not the beginning of EastEnders. That's basically all the rocks just beginning to fall to the ground. Not thrown and missing her. She can hear the thuds, probably thinking, are they coming now? And then realizes they're actually being dropped to the ground and the crowd begin to disperse. And you're left with this really intimate encounter. Jesus and essentially this naked woman who's utterly, utterly humiliated. And he says to her, lady, do they condemn you? Do the crowd condemn you? And she's kind of looking around, probably trembling, and says like, no, don't think they do. He says, neither do I condemn you. Go and leave your life of sin. Now imagine this moment for her. She's cowering, she's terrified, and she looks up to the face of Jesus, not just a teacher of the law, but the lawgiver. The one that gave the Torah is standing in front of her, and she begins to look up, terrified that she's going to look into the face of God and she's going to see judgment. As she looks up, she sees Jesus and she sees mercy. How amazing is that? How amazing is that? What you've got to understand here is this is a moment of phenomenal reversal. If you've read the beginning of the story, Genesis 1 and Genesis 2, which is a vision of what it means to be human, Adam and Eve are running around, they're naked and they're unashamed. Like naked, this picture of freedom. But they're not ashamed about their bodies. They're just like loving it as they run around this garden of perfection. That's what we were made for, right? I want you to notice that for this woman, it's the exact opposite. She's surrounded. She's not free. She's naked and she's not, you know, unashamed. She's absolutely ashamed. She's absolutely mortified in this moment. And then she looks at the face of Jesus and it changes everything. Like restored to life as it was meant to be in the Garden of Eden. Now, I've said this before, but if you look at the name of Jesus, the actual Aramaic name, it's Yahshua. It gets translated Jesus, obviously. But Yahshua, the full name is Yehoshua, from which we get Joshua. It literally means Yahweh, which is the name for God in the Old Testament. Yahweh saves. But the root word of Yehoshua is Yasha. It's a Hebrew term that means salvation. It literally means a wide open space, like Eden. That's how the Jewish community understood freedom, like living life in this wide open space, expansive living. So the name Jesus, Yehoshua, literally means Yahweh will lead you to a wide open space. If you're surrounded, if you're enslaved, if you're trapped, then what he will do is will overcome the obstacles, bang down the door so that you can be free. And as this one woman looks into the face of Jesus, just one glance, and she enters the wide open space. And I don't know about you, but I want everyone I know, everyone I meet, to catch a glimpse of the face of Jesus, because it will bring freedom. I want to tell everyone I know about the face of Jesus. I want them to understand the character, the nature, the essence of God, because I believe it will bring people to life. Let me tell you one other story. Zacchaeus. Zacchaeus was a tax collector. You can read it in Luke 19. Tax collectors were despised. You'll probably know this. But in the first century, the way the Roman Empire operated is they would overpower the surrounding nations and expand the empire. And then to sort of like weaken the surrounding nations, they'd put a tax system upon them which would financially cripple them so that they couldn't develop an army that would sort of fight back to bring freedom. So essentially, the Romans put this tax system on the Jewish community, and then they would find weak people in the Jewish community to collect the taxes. Like, you go and collect the money, bring it back to the Romans, and as you give the money to the Romans, they'll say, and you keep this percent for yourself. So the Jewish community were getting poorer and poorer and poorer, literally selling off land, selling off possessions just to keep food on the table. And these tax collectors were getting richer and richer and richer. So you've got the poor and you've got the rich, and the poor despising the rich, because their poverty was leading to the wealth of people like Zacchaeus. So they'd betrayed God and the covenant relationship that the people had with God. They'd betrayed the Jewish community, and they were in league with the Romans, with the enemies, right? So the Jewish people hated the tax collectors. So there's this guy called Zacchaeus, and he hears that Jesus is going to be passing through town. And he wants to find out about this Jesus. He's heard the rumors that, like, he's an amazing rabbi, an incredible prophet. He's healing the sick and raising the dead, announcing the arrival of the kingdom of God. He's making some pretty lofty claims that he's God himself. He's like, I want to catch a glimpse of this guy. So he basically goes and visits the place where Jesus is preaching. And it says that he climbs a sycamore tree because he wants to see what's going on, right? Now, if you're short, and I'm not particularly tall myself, 5'10", 5'8", okay. So like, I'm not particularly tall, average for a guy though. I know what it's like to be in a crowd and not be able to see, right? And as someone that isn't particularly tall, I know the techniques. What you do is you start on the periphery and you just gently just nudge your way to the front. Hey, good to see you. Yeah, out of the way. Yeah, good to see you. And then just begin to use your elbows. Yeah, lovely to see you. Out of the way. And then you eventually get to the front and you have an amazing picture of what's going on, right? So if someone's small, they don't need to climb a tree. They can just push their way to the front. Unless you're hated. And when you try and push your way to the front, everyone sees that it's you, Zacchaeus, and like, get away. No way. He scum and gets pushed back. So he knows he can't push his way to the front because he's despised. So he climbs a tree. And then Jesus is preaching. And as he's preaching, he notices Zacchaeus and he calls Zacchaeus by name. Says, Zacchaeus. And again, just imagine this moment as the crowd turn towards the tax collector who's in the tree. What an idiot. What are you doing up there? And then the tension begins. Because everyone in the crowd despises Zacchaeus. And suddenly you've got not just a teacher of the law, but the Torah giver, like in the crowd, teaching, preaching. And everyone in the crowd is thinking, okay, we know what's about to happen. And Jesus is about to publicly humiliate Zacchaeus. He's betrayed the covenant relationship God made with his people. He's betrayed his own people. He's in league with the Romans, with the enemies. Like, we despise Zacchaeus, and we would love to tell him so. But now we're going to get to watch a rabbi, like, take him down, cut him down to size. He's already pretty short, but he's going to get cut right down. People in the crowd would have probably been saying, hey, listen to this, kids. That guy up there, you see that guy up there? He's going to be humiliated. This is going to be fun. Listen, listen and learn. So they're wanting this moment where they can feel this sense of revenge of this guy that's betrayed them, you know, is going to be shredded by Jesus. And then Jesus actually says to Zacchaeus, he says, Zacchaeus, I'd love to come to your house tonight. You're like, what? Now, we don't get the full weight of that, but you need to know in the context of the day, having dinner with someone was a sign of friendship. So when Jesus says, I would like to come to your house for dinner today, he's basically saying, hey, Zacchaeus, I'd like to be your friend. Like, I know everyone hates you. And I know that you probably didn't choose tax collecting. No one sort of grows up and thinks, oh, when I'm old, I'd like to be hated by the Romans, by my own people. I'd like to be a tax collector. No one chooses that. So I know you're hurting like hell and everyone despises you. But I want you to know, and I want you to know publicly, that I want to be your friend. Imagine that moment. He's looking down from the tree, looking into the face of God, probably terrified that as he looks into the face of Jesus, he's going to see a face of judgment, a face of disappointment and disapproval. And as he looks down, terrified, he sees mercy. He sees mercy. He sees these eyes of love. And he gets down from the tree and he's like, "You want to be my friend? Let's go and have some food." And they go and have dinner together. And we don't know what happened over dinner, but we do know that after dinner, Jesus announces proudly, "Today salvation has come to this house." Do you remember that word, yasha, salvation? Wide open space. Today, this guy, Zacchaeus, has been led into a wide open space. And then we read that he basically gives half of his possessions to the poor. This is a guy that was defined by wealth, in love with money. And one encounter with Jesus, he gives half of it away. And everyone that he'd ripped off, which would have been a lot of people, he gives back four times the amount. This is total, total transformation. Why? Because he dared to look into the face of Jesus. It's just one glance. That's all it takes. One glance of looking into the face of Jesus. And when you see the mercy that triumphs over judgment, when you see the love, it transforms your heart. It transforms every part of your being. Why wouldn't we be looking into the face of Jesus? One other passage, if you've got a Bible, Exodus 33. I want to read you this one other beautiful text about Moses. And this is before the arrival of Jesus, right? In the context of the wider narrative of Scripture. So it's in Jesus that we fully see the face of God. It's in Jesus that we know what God is like. It's at the cross that we see what mercy really looks like. That mercy really does triumph over judgment. Because rather than experiencing judgment, we see that God wraps himself in human flesh and dies a brutal death so that we don't need to live just in judgment, but that mercy could triumph over it so that we could live the lives we were meant to live, fully free in the wide open space in relationship with our Maker, right? So that's what Jesus accomplishes, but this is pre-Jesus. And this guy called Moses asks a really bold question, essentially says to God, "I'd like to see your face, but I want to give you the context for the story, and we're going to read a bit of it together." So this is Exodus 33. And just before this, if you know the Exodus story, you've had some really fun moments, right? Where you've got the 10 plagues, and then God liberates the people after 400 years of slavery, and they pass through the Red Sea. That's an amazing miracle. And there's provision in the wilderness, and then Moses ascends the mountain, and God says to this people group, "I choose you, and we're going to get married, if you like, and I'll be, you know, the husband, you'll be my wife, and we'll be wedded to one another. And because I'm the source of life, if we're connected and wedded in this covenant together, life will flow from me to you, and you will know fullness of life." Of all the nations, God says to the Jewish people, "I choose you." Just imagine that moment. They'd seen this incredible liberation. And what do? So Moses ascends the mountain to enter into this covenant relationship, and God gives them the Ten Commandments, guidelines towards human flourishing. And whilst Moses is up the mountain, they're at the bottom of the mountain, and some, you know, loser comes up with an idea of like, "Why don't we just pull all our jewelry and melt it down? This is brilliant. And what we'll do is we'll make a golden calf and then let's worship it. That's a cracking idea. Let's do that." And everyone's like, "Yeah, that really does sound like a fantastic idea. Let's just pull our jewelry, melt it down, form a little golden cow, and then bow down and worship it. Brilliant. Well done. Let's do it." And they begin to do it. So Moses has been hanging out with God, the all-powerful God, Yahweh, who's liberated them, overpowered the Egyptians, imparted the Red Sea so that they could be free, journeying with them in the wilderness towards the promised land. And they're at the base of the mountain worshiping this little golden calf, right? Madness. And after that, Moses wants to have a conversation with God. Now, he's the leader of the people. He's representing the people to God, right? So he's probably anxious. "I can't believe people have done this, that God has drawn close to us and he's liberated us and he's chosen us as his treasured possession. This is the most incredible thing. And our response to his grace is to turn our back on him and worship a little golden cow." Like, what is God going to say? Like, to be honest, Moses might be fearing judgment, right? If I get to look at the face of God, he's going to be angry. He's going to be angry. And this is the conversation that takes place. Verse 12, Moses said to the Lord, you've been telling me, lead these people, but you have not let me know whom you'll send with me. You've said, I know you by name and you've found favor with me. If you're pleased with me, teach me your way so I may know you and continue to find favor with you. Remember that this nation is your people. Just pushing away a bit of responsibility. They're your people, nothing to do with me, your people. The Lord replied, my presence will go with you and I'll give you rest. Then Moses said to him, if your presence does not go with us, do not send us up from here. How will anyone know that you're pleased with me and with your people unless you go with us? What else will distinguish me and your people from all the other people on the face of the earth? Now, I don't think you can probably see this on the screen, but I've tried to highlight the key words here that indicate the state of Moses' heart, right? I know these are heroes of the faith, but they're human beings, right? With insecurities and areas of real brokenness. And if you just glance through the text, you begin to see the fragility within Moses. What does he want to know from God? He's like, do I carry your favor? Like, are you pleased with me? Repeat it again. Like, do I carry your favor? Like, are you pleased with me? This is a fragile human being representing a people that have turned their backs on God. And as deep as long as God, I just want to know your heart towards me. Like, I quite like to see your face and just, are you disappointed in me? Do you disapprove of me? Like, or are you pleased with me? Like, do I carry your favor? Do you delight in me? Let's keep reading then, verse 17. And the Lord said to Moses, I'll do the very thing you've asked because I am... No, it's tough to read, I guess. Because I'm pleased with you and know you by name. That's everything Moses was longing to hear, right? I'm going to do everything you've just asked. Why? Because I'm pleased with you. Imagine the relief you've just heard the creator of the universe say over you, a fragile human being, I'm pleased with you. You have my favor. I delight in you. Imagine that. But for Moses, it's not enough. And this is really gutsy what happens next. In verse 18, then Moses said, Now show me your glory. Now again, we don't really understand this, but in the ancient world, one's glory was revealed in their face. If you wanted to know someone's story, if you wanted to know their nature, if you wanted to know their character, you would look them in the face. So Moses is basically saying, like, I've heard the words that you're pleased, and that means a lot. But what I'd really love is just to see your face. Like, to see your face as you gaze upon me. I want to see what's in your eyes. Are you pleased? You know, do you delight in who I am and what I'm about? And this is what God responds by saying. He says, I will cause all my goodness to pass in front of you, and I'll proclaim my name, the Lord, in your presence. I'll have mercy on whom I'll have mercy. I'll have compassion on whom I'll have compassion. But, he said, you cannot see my face, for no one may see me and live. God's basically saying to Moses, okay, here's the deal. Like, if you were to see my full heart towards you, my pride and my delight and my passion for who you are and what you're about, it would overwhelm you. Your body couldn't take it. If your body was to experience the full weight of my glory, your body would just fall apart. It can't cope with that level of glory, that level of delight, that level of love. But here's the deal. And if you keep on reading, God says, you can't see my face, but I'm going to hide you in the cleft of this rock, and then I will pass by, and you can glimpse my back. And Moses is like, okay, great, let's just do that. So Moses climbs the mountain, hides in this cleft of the rock, and God passes by. And I don't know what Moses was doing. My guess is sort of like just wanting to see, but just not sure. Is he going to sort of fall to the ground dead as he sees the glory of God? And as he sort of looks and the glory of God passes by, like something in him just comes to life. Rather than dying, he comes alive because he sees, even by just glimpsing the back, the delight in the heart of God, like the pleasure in the heart of God, that God loves Moses, that God loves the people of God. And like, this is like a turning point in the whole narrative of scriptures. People begin to understand that as they look at the face of God, they're not going to see judgment. They're going to see mercy. They're going to see love, and that love will lead them to life. How beautiful is that? How beautiful is that? And even though he just saw a glimpse of God's back, And when Moses came back down from that mountain, his face was radiating. So much so, the people said, look, if we see the face of God, we'll die. But looking at your face, it's overwhelming us. We can't do it. So can you just wear a veil for a little while? Because you are radiating. Whatever you saw, it was good. You are radiating the love of God, the glory of God, the mercy of God, the heart of God. How amazing is that? Want to close with just one more video. A number of years ago, I was going through some stuff in my own life, aware of like some pretty serious insecurities, and some of my own brokenness was emerging. And I was asking some of these big questions of like, God, how do you see me? Like, what is your heart towards me? And more than that, I was asking it not just of God, but of like my parents and family, just experiencing some insecurity, some identity stuff, and yet wanting to know what my Father in heaven thought of me. And I watched this video one night. It was the BAFTA ceremony. And basically that year, the Lifetime Achievement Award went to a guy called Lord Putnam. Hand in the air if you've heard of Lord Putnam. Yeah, exactly, three of you. So not many of you. He was an incredible filmmaker of sort of like my generation, so maybe most would be a bit too old, young to remember it. But films like Memphis Belle, ring any bells? Pun intended. Chariots of Fire, The Killing Fields, The Mission, some of these incredible films. And he'd won the Oscars for some of these different films, but then he won this Lifetime Achievement Award. And he gets up and he gives this speech when he receives this award. And as he just gave this speech, honestly, it hit me like a ton of bricks. Just the stuff that was stirring deep within, suddenly someone gave language to it. And I felt like, oh, Lord, you're speaking to me. Like, I'm listening. I want to open myself to your love. I want to look at you in the face. So I want to show you the video. You may say I'm a dreamer.
The last thing is the trickiest. The most admirable human being I ever met was my dad. My dad was extraordinary. And like a lot of kids born during the war, I didn't meet him until I was five. So he was that much more extraordinary to me. And the only sadness I ever suffered, nothing like the sort of things that Dick and others have had to put up with, was that just a couple of weeks, 25 years ago, just a couple of weeks before I won the BAFTA Award for Chariots and then went on and won it in Los Angeles, won the Oscar. My dad had died. And so this talismanic, this extraordinary man, and I never had the opportunity to exchange that glance or hug each other. And that left a hole. But movies, you know, have got an amazing way of detecting those moments. They speak to us. Every single one of you has sat in a movie house and watched some moment of your life healed or addressed, or touched, something that you thought that only you knew. There are a number of films I could relate that did this, but I've only got time for one. Bear with me. I guess a lot of you, I hope a lot of you, saw the movie The Sixth Sense. It's a very fine film. Do you remember the final scene when Toni Collette is in the car with her son? She's had a very difficult life. She's a single mother who's had a tough time. And she'd had to come to terms with the fact that her son can speak to the spirit world. And the little boy says to her, "Mummy, is it true? Grandma told me that shortly after she died, you went and visited her graveside." And Toni Collette says, "Yeah, that's true." And Grandma said, you asked her a question. Is that true?" She said, "Yeah. Yes, I did ask Grandma a question." Well, he says, "Grandma wants you to know that the answer to that question is yes every single day." "But Mum, what was the question?" And Toni Collette starts to cry. And through her tears, she said, "I just asked her if she'd ever been proud of me." I remember that hitting me like a punch in the stomach. And tonight, I know absolutely for sure, I never really have to answer the question again, that thanks to you and your generosity, my dad's very proud, my family's very proud, and I am more proud than I ever believed I could be. Thank you so much.
Amazing speech, right? And I'm guessing we can all connect with that. There's probably moments you've experienced in life where you've succeeded, you've accomplished something, and you just turn to find someone's face in the crowd because you want to see their face of pride, of delight. You want to see it for yourself. And something in me as I watched it was like, oh, Lord, I want to see your face. I want to see your face. This is one of the tragedies, I think, of some people that follow the way of Jesus. They've never found the guts to say, God, I just want to ask the question, can I see your face? Did you ever feel pride in me? Because those that ask the question will find the answer in the face of Jesus. And what you find, the answer is yes, every single day. Just one glance can transform your life as you see the love of the Father in the face of Jesus. I want to finish with an exercise. So I just want to encourage everyone, maybe just to close their eyes. Don't worry, nothing weird's going to happen. No one's going to stroke your knee or do anything strange. I'm just going to play a piece of music. I'm going to ask you some questions. And I don't want you to go digging for stuff in your inner world. But I do want you to welcome in the presence of Jesus and allow him just to search your hearts. I want to ask you the question, where in life do you feel like you're succeeding right now? Is there anything you've accomplished in the last few weeks, months that you're proud of? And in those moments where you've just done something that felt significant, I want to ask you, who's the person you call? Whose face do you look for in the crowd? And I know this stuff is hard at times, but it matters, doesn't it? My father-in-law died a few months ago, and I know my wife. Desperately wants to see the face of her dad. For others, it will be hard because you grew up and maybe a father figure, a mother figure, an authority figure was never really there in the key moments. The school performance, first day of university or whatever it might be, they just weren't there and you never got to see their face. And therefore you live with this ache of, was mum ever proud? Was dad ever proud? Was ... ever proud? Second question, where does it hurt right now? Are there any areas in your life where it feels like you're just drowning? Things at work are tough. Maybe you've lost a loved one and you're grieving. A relationship didn't work out as you thought it was going to work out. When you're hurting, who do you turn to? Who's the first call? Whose face do you look into to find strength to carry on? And I want to make it clear that it's absolutely natural, it's totally appropriate to look for some of that stuff in the face of our family members, our friends, of people that we love and that people that we trust. But looking in the face of another human being can't satisfy the deepest longings of the human heart. We were built for connection with one another, but we were built for connection with God. So there's moments when we taste success, we accomplish something, a vision becomes a reality, that Jesus would simply say, look to me. I want you to see the pride on my face. And there's moments where we totally screw up and things begin to fall apart. And Jesus would say, look to me. And you will see grace in my eyes, and you will see mercy, and you will see love. To be seen is to be known, and to be known is to be loved, and to be loved is to be healed. Okay, you can open your eyes. So what? So what? How do we respond? Let me just land with this. If you're here and you don't know Jesus, then welcome. Just love the fact that you're in the room. You're really welcome here at KXC. But want to encourage you, if you want to find out more about this person who the followers of Jesus love and adore and center their lives around, the Alpha Course is an incredible opportunity to ask all these questions, to explore the character and the nature of Jesus. And there will be others in the room that don't believe, that would describe themselves as atheists. There'll be other agnostics. There'll be people of other faith groups that are just inquisitive about church, inquisitive about the person of Jesus, or fancy someone in the room and want to be there. Just want to encourage you, if you're in any of those categories, like the Alpha Course is for you. Come and explore the person of Jesus. If you're new to faith and you want to build deeper foundations, come and explore the person of Jesus. So I want to invite you to Alpha. It starts this Tuesday. This Tuesday, come along. We'd love to see you there. The second thing then, for those in the room that do know and love Jesus, if you've looked into the face of God, and even it's just been a glimpse, and you've seen something of his love and his affection, his mercy and his grace and his power to heal, why would you not invite other people to look at the face of Jesus? Why would you not be inviting friends to come and explore this one person with whom just one glance can transform your life? Recent research suggests that 20% of people in this country are waiting to be invited to church. They're more than just interested in the subject of spirituality. They're interested in church and they're interested in the person of Jesus, but they're waiting to be invited. Doesn't that break your heart? If you go through the phone list, your contact list on your mobile phone, probably hundreds of numbers, right? Like one in five is waiting to be invited. They're waiting for someone to say, look, do you want to come with me? Because I'd love for you to see the face of Jesus. Because in his face, you're going to find a love that leads you to life.